You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You are in for a treat. It's one of those films that once you immerse yourself in, I have to give a special recommendation to Johnny Greenwood and his score and the cinematography as well.
The whole cast is fantastic.
If you love Jane Campion and you commit yourself to it being a slow burn and you take it in, the reward you get out of it is justified.
It just changes direction completely and it just catches everybody by surprise. When I walked out of the cinema, I was just like, holy crap, that just blew my mind completely.
That's Jane Campion for you.
Hey everybody, welcome to this episode of Flixwatch Podcast. Today, we are joined by Kelechi.
Hey, how's it going?
Katie.
Hello.
And Helen.
Hello.
And we're going to be talking about the power of the dog.
Thank you, as always, to the mighty people for the mighty, mighty tunes. And thanks to Ben from Rockwood Audio for his awesome editing skills.
Please do remember to write a review and rate us on Apple Podcasts and anywhere you can do where you listen to the podcast, because it really does help us.
And you can join in the conversation with us on Twitter
at FlixWatcherPod and on Instagram
at FlixWatcher.
Hello, film fans. Welcome to FlixWatcher Podcast. Joining us remotely today, we have Katie and Kelechi. If you could please say hello to our listeners and tell them a little bit more about who you are and what you do, please.
My name's Kelechi and I'm a film critic, and it's great to be here to talk about Power of the Dog.
Hi, I'm Katie Smith-Wong. I'm a London-based film critic as well, and I write for a number of sites as well as the reviews editor for Flickfeast.
Kelechi, where can we read your words?
So I write for several different outlets. So one is my own personal blog, which is Confessions from a Geek Mind. And I also write for Film Stories, Jump Cut Online, Vulture Hound, Film Hounds Magazine, and Set the Tape.
Tell us about Confessions of a Geek Mind.
That blog started back in 2013. I was encouraged by a friend of mine to start writing about films because they said I was very knowledgeable, and I was just like, who's gonna read my thoughts and so forth. And one day, you know, had the flu, and through that I just said, you know what, I'm bored, I'm sick, maybe I should start a blog. And since 2013, it's just carried on, and lo and behold, people have been reading it and have found some really amazing substance out of it, which is, you know, it's always great when you hear positive feedback. And that's just opened the doors to different, you know, outlets and opportunities to the point where I am today. So it's a journey, and I'm very appreciative about how that journey started.
So start a blog, kids. That's what you need to do. I started a blog like 2008, wasn't kept up that much, but it's still like really informative to what I do now, and making websites and doing digital marketing and stuff like that. And hey, this podcast and stuff, because it was about film and TV and all that kind of stuff. So if you've got any outlet creatively, try starting a blog. Katie, do you have a blog?
I do, actually. That's how I started film writing as well. I was nearing 30. I wasn't sure what to do. I was in a job that I didn't find fulfilling. So I was in between jobs and I started writing about films because, you know, I had something to pass the time, and it just started to develop into something I was becoming a lot more serious and passionate about. Mm-hmm. And then from there, it led me to network with different sites, not only in the UK, but overseas as well. And that made me, taught me a lot more about film writing as well. And then it also introduced me to other journalists and other sites, to the point where I am now. So yeah, I'm not only the reviews editor for Flick Feast, but I've written for film stories like Kelechi and Godzilla, Movie Marker, New Scientist magazine. New Scientist. They have a culture section and do film reviews. So I've reviewed a number of documentaries for them.
Nice.
And as well as a number of podcasts, which includes the Empire podcast.
Yeah, well, I heard you on the most recent episode as this is recorded. So, and that's where I first heard your name. I thought, oh, she sounds interesting. Katie Smith Wong. Well, welcome, guys. We're going to be talking today about the power of the dog. Katie, this was your choice.
Yes, it was.
First of all, why? And then tell us what it's about. And when we get to what it's about, we got 1 minute or less, and I'll bring up the countdown timer to go through your synopsis.
Okay. Well, I brought this up because I first watched it at London Film Festival earlier this year, and it was one of the standout films of the selection, in my opinion. The film is based on the eponymous novel by Tom Savage and is directed by Palme d'Or winner James Campion. It stars an ensemble cast with Benedict Cumberbatch, Jesse Plemons, Kirsten Dunst, and Cody Smith-McPhee. And it's based about two rancher brothers in Montana, Phil and George Burbank. Phil is quite a volatile character, and he is a bit domineering. So when George falls in love and marries Rose, who is played by Kirsten Dunst, and she moves into their home, he's very antagonistic towards her, to the point where there's just an unfathomable tension that drives the film to a very surprising and unexpected climax.
Nice. Did you know about it before? Oh, hold on, there's a timer. Okay. Damn it. Obviously, LFF is great. Film festivals are great fun because you just go in there and you think, well, I'm going to sit down and watch a load of films. How much were you looking forward to this beforehand? And how much did you know, how much were you reading into the hype? Or were you just thinking, Jane Campion, new film, go. And then you're in the zone.
Before it was shown at LFF, there was a lot of hype behind it because it was Jane Campion and it had this really great cast that had, you know, Ben Cumberbatch is just becoming this humongous star from Sherlock. And you got Jesse Plemons and Kirsten Dunst, who's, you know, return to the big screen. And especially as I was growing, I've been growing up with her. She's been in movies since I was young. So to see her now, it's just to have this kind of performance is quite great to watch as well. And then you have Cody Smith-McPhee, who, you know, people know him from the X-Men movies. As quite an underrated character, but here he actually shines on his own, matches the caliber of his fellow castmates.
Kelechi, did you know about it before you watched it the first time? I guess I'm also potentially very jealous here because you guys saw it in the cinema and this is going to lean into my small screen score, but go on.
Yeah, I just knew it was a Jane Campion film that was coming out. So I sort of missed the hype. And that's kind of always a good thing because you can just walk into the cinema and just kind of be blind to the noise and just actually just sit back and watch it. I've been a fan of Jane Campion for a while, so not only from the piano, but from actually a TV series that she also did for the BBC called Top of the Lake. And that starred Elizabeth Moss in it. And it's like a crime detective drama. And what she does in The Power of the Dog, which is very symptomatic of all of her work, is that slow build drama. And it's very methodical. It's very, at times, intense. And it all builds up to a impact or a crescendo or something like that. And it's her in her element. So for me, I was very excited just to be, you know, seeing what that next project was, because it, you know, it does take her a while to do new projects in between. And it also feels like it's also like a special occasion as well. So when I heard that she had a new film, Power of the Dog, I was just like, right, I'm ready for that next Jane Campion film. So.
And did it meet your expectations, guys?
Absolutely. It just took me by surprise, to be honest, because... It sounds like a cliche, but when you settle into it and you feel you get a grip of what's going on, especially with the characters being as they are, you just become almost, you feel that it's just going one direction. And as a director, you have to adjust yourself to become comfortable with, because it's so unsettling. But then it just changes direction completely and it just catches everybody by surprise. When I walked out of the cinema, I was just like, holy crap, I did. That was just blew my mind completely.
That's Jane Campion for you. That's, I have to say it unceremoniously. But as Katie said, it is how the story shifts, because one minute you are watching a film about two brothers and you think, okay, maybe this is what the film's about. Then once Jesse Plemons' character, who plays George, takes an interest in Kirsten Dunst's character, Rose, it becomes almost like a film about jealousy, about a brother trapped in the past and recognizing that his other brother is basically moving on with his life and also moving up in the social circles. And then it shifts again and you kind of almost sit in there thinking, okay, where's this film going? Like, there's almost like three different films, but it's not something that is like almost like a whiplash. It's very gentle. It's very subtle. Yeah. And the way it each transitions, I'm not going to spoil the end because that is the money shot.
You can give spoilers.
I can spoil? Okay.
Yeah.
So the fact that it shifts into basically an episode of How to Get Away with Murder, like I half expected, you know, Annalise Keating to just rock up in the high heels and like just walk into the scene. Because it is a devastating impact, what happens. And it just shows you the level of character building. It shows a level of intricacy in the whole film. And that is led superbly by Benedict Cumberbatch.
Helen, what were your thoughts on The Power of the Dog?
So, also a big Campion fan. I think The Piano was probably like the first film by a female director that I ever saw.
You could have said Campion Champion. I'll
missed that one, didn't I? You can have that one. You can have that one. It just felt different watching that. So sadly did not get to see this in the cinema or at any film festival and had absolutely no idea it was coming to Netflix so soon until you picked it. And when we got the choices through, very, very, very excited. And I think it probably surpassed my expectations. I think that sometimes her films can be quite brilliant, but have moments in that don't quite work, or there's some things that she kind of tries and don't quite land well. And I was kind of expecting a bit of that. But yeah, I was really surprised with it and did not kind of expect the kind of the third act turn where things go dark. And yeah, I mean, we've not talked about it yet, but Benedict Cumberbatch, he can be a bit hit and miss with me. I find that he can often like act a bit too much with his face, but this was a little bit more of an all-round performance.
Sorry.
Do you know what I mean? It's just like a bit facey and nothing else. But I think I'm still not 100% sure whether I think he was perfect in it, but it was kind of interesting.
It was close to perfect.
I think it's... I know what you mean, Helen, because it feels like it's a bit of a miscast. Because here is a guy who's meant to be playing this kind of toxic, like the embodiment of toxic masculinity and what the ideal man is. But underneath that, it's everything about him is a contradiction. And that even includes like his size, his weight, his transition into his repressed feelings about, you know, and his, you know, his love with Bronco Henry, and what that past trauma or even past love and how that shapes him into what he thinks is what a man is. And basically looking around with his brother, who is definitely the antithesis of him. He's very shy, can't really speak, can't really say anything. But he's somebody who's very direct and forward. And then you're looking at everybody else and he thinks everybody's weak. Everybody is not to a standard. And he's almost like the last frontier, the last representation of it until he gets his, I don't want to say reward, but comeuppance, I should say.
Yeah.
But, I mean, how much do you think of it is him projecting out because he knows he has his repressed feelings or, you know, the feelings he can't show in this quote unquote macho world?
Well, that's the thing about the film. It plays itself in two halves. One is the first half sees him could be a complete asshole towards Rose. You're not sure why. You think it's because of jealousy, the fact that she in his eyes is taking George away from this male dominated environment and she doesn't fit in there. And then you see the second way, where he actually bonds with Peter, Rose's son, who's played by Smith McPhee. And it's like, okay, you could, is this genuine, or are you just trying to weaponize Peter against Rose because, you know, he's her son. But then, when they start to have like heart to heart, you kind of wonder, especially when you see him in the gut, having a private moment. I think that's the best way to put it. Having a private moment involving a handkerchief, Bronco Henry's handkerchief, to be a bit more specific. You wonder if his feelings towards Peter are that of a mentor or of something more. And you just kind of, it just keeps you on tether hooks as to who this character really is. Is he supposed to be? Is he trying to pretend to be someone that he isn't, or is he trying to be something more? And I think that's what you find yourself asking at the end of the film.
Yeah, I love how ambiguous it is. Mm. Like you're never settled in trying to decipher. Like what's great about Campion's work is that it just leaves it open ended, and it just leaves it to interpretation. So with Cumberbatch, you have something that is very complex and very nuanced, as with all the characters that are there. But that is the great mystery about his performance. And that's why I think you probably rewatch it just to see if there's another secret revealed or something you missed the first time around.
I think the rewatch will be interesting here because, as you said, the nuance and the different layers, how you peel back the onion behind Peter Burbank will be interesting because it's his relationship that he ends up having with Phil. Is it a latent romantic one? Is it is he trying to get one up on Rose and George? Is it one of like, oh, actually, I maybe need to just protect this guy because I see a kindred spirit here. It's not romantic myself, but also I need to make sure he's going to be able to take care of himself because otherwise he's going to be like victimized throughout the rest of his life. And those are the kind of three things that I was kind of toying with in my mind. And I'm sure there's probably more things that are there that are kind of bubbling away. But I think it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. Because the first time we see Phil and Peter interacting was in the restaurant, and he sees him playing with the flower. And I think perhaps off the cuff it was just I'm going to make fun of this guy because I need to make sure that I'm the alpha male here and everyone around me needs to know I'm the alpha. But you know, when it becomes part of like, this guy's going to actually be in my life, then the dynamics change. And I think the dynamics change in an interesting way which I would never have foreseen.
It's almost like if this kind of like thing, whether if he's exposed, then he becomes exposed. So if they keep it hidden, then no one will really know. And they can have like the secret hidden mud bath and secret stash of sexy magazines.
Like, alternatively, if he feels that he bonds with Peter, it kind of makes him feel not as inferior in terms of his own feelings. Mm-hmm. He doesn't feel as scared as he should be about, you know, about his past or about his life with Bronco Henry. It does keep you, and you just find, yeah, like you said, you find yourself trying to find hints of clear cut facts as to what this guy really is. And it just makes you keep watching and watching. And the hints are there. When you rewatch it, you can see and hear everything that leads to that crescendo. Mm-hmm. But you don't factor in their significance until that point.
Yeah. Do you think you see Phil, when he sees Peter, sees a bit about himself in there? Maybe that's how he was before he met Bronco Henry. And then under his wing, he became, quote unquote, a man.
I think so. I think definitely. And I think when initially it was, oh shit, this guy knows who I am, so maybe I need to keep him close. Because he sees the intimate scene with the handkerchief. And then I think he actually starts to think, oh, this guy's got something. Like when they were talking about what Phil sees in the mountains, and he's like, and Pete says, yes, there's the shadow of the dog. He's like, what? You saw that? What? You really? You saw that? And I think that's when he starts thinking, there's something here about this kid that, you know, there's something special here. And that's when I think he really does start to feel like, oh, I need to make this rope for him because this is an important like relationship here. Again, we're still super, not just ambiguous. There's multiple different layers. We don't know where it's going to go, but still, I think he really does form that bond with him to the extent that when he's in delirium, that he feels the thing he needs to do is make the rope, isn't it?
Yeah, especially when Peter doesn't actually have a father figure because, you know, his own father passed away and George is not really very attentive in my eyes, I don't think he's a great husband.
No, he's neglected. Not, he's not even in the film most of the time.
No, I was like, what kind of, you know, he's missing half the film. He doesn't see that that Rose is, you know, suffering and descending into alcoholism. And
he buys her a piano that's not worth, that she doesn't want to play.
Yeah.
Making a play in front of his parents.
And the governor has to say, are you sure you want to be married to that guy, especially with his arsehole of a brother? It does raise questions about the supposed good guy, you know, persona that he's trying to play. He said, oh, I'm a good guy, but you know, I'm just ignoring you because I want to be something more. anyway, that's just me.
I think that's spot on, because in some ways that, as I think you and Kobe said, about alpha males and how who's going to be the dominant one, and you can see with Georgie's probably thinking, well, I can't be like my brother, I'm going to climb the social ladder. So you see him wearing the fancy suits, you see him almost you know, I think there's one point he was wearing like almost like a fur coat, like very chic like fur coat whilst riding a horse, and you can tell he's just very different. And the only way of how he can be a quote unquote an alpha male is to escape that household, because his brother owns the masculinity, he owns the control of it. So this is his way of showing that kind of, you know, his way forward. The difference is that, as Katie alluded to, he neglects his wife and is part of the problem of what Rose goes through. You know, it's also the intimidation that she gets from Phil, like in one scene where she's trying to learn to play the piano again, or refresh her mind, and then he's walking in, and the beauty of Cumberbatch's performance is that when he walks into the room, you just hear like, what is it, the Stetsons, and you just hear that, and it's like he's just and that in itself is a sign of intimidation, and that just sends the fear through the scene, and then he's just bringing out the banjo and then just outshines her. That in itself shows you how creepy and intense of it is, and basically dials up the psychological tension for Rose. But on the flip side, you have a neglectful husband who literally is all about himself and basically treats Rose almost like a trophy.
But that's how Dunst actually shines. She just puts in amazing performance that shows that she's not afraid to be fragile. Her slow descent into alcoholism is just, you can see her broken, a broken shell of a woman, especially when during the dinner party, you see that she's practically saying with her expression, okay, Phil, you win. I can't do anything while you're here. But she can't say anything to her husband because she probably knows it in the back of her mind, he can't do anything. And that fact that she's able to just be so repressed, she just plays this repressed character who is suffering so quietly, is why she's just so good in this role.
It's such a like reserved performance from her, and you kind of feel for her because she's obviously this woman who has been widowed and her husband has committed the ultimate sin in kind of God's eyes, and you know, this is the offer she probably never would have got. So she kind of has to take the marriage, really. It's not something you could turn down, a woman in her position, and you get the feeling she doesn't really enjoy her work. And there's just so many emotions going on. And her only son is now being taken away by this man who is kind of just everywhere around her. It's a really great performance from her. And maybe a different actress might have played it a bit too much, but yeah, she's brilliant. And in fact, the whole cast is fantastic.
Can I just ask before we go into the rest of the cast, but did you, with Rose, do you get the, was the fear that, I don't know, I was kind of toying with the fear of Rose thinking that she actually sees through Pete and actually sees Pete as predatory in terms of actually wanting to, you know, have some kind of relationship with her son, or was it just purely she thinks he's a bad guy and he's trying to, you know, cause him some harm? Or is, because I thought that was another couple of layers of ambiguity there. I don't know. That's, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think she saw Phil as a threat by using Peter, because when Phil started taking P- Peter out for horseback rides, she actually runs out in distress saying, where's he mm-hmm. taking him? I don't want him hanging around him. And she was trying to, because Pete, in her eyes, Peter's the only one that has her back. He's the only thing that's tying her to a better life, i.e. away from the ranch. Mm. And so the fact that in her eyes, Phil's taking him away from her just adds to her distress.
And turning Peter against her as well, because we see kind of the conversations and you're sort of like, is Peter kind of buying this? Because it's so ambiguous in kind of tones and you're like thinking, oh, is he actually listening to Phil? And is he going to take all what he's saying about her alcoholism and everything on board? And is he going to manage to like manipulate him against it? So I don't think I've seen the actor who plays Peter before in anything. I'm not sure. Which X-Men was in? I haven't seen.
He was Nightcrawler.
Yeah. Yeah. So you wouldn't necessarily recognize him in the X-Men, but he was in Slow West, in another Western, which is really good fun. He's been around recently. He's only 25. So it's like, he's one of these people. I'm like, damn you. Youngness.
It's kind of got an interesting physical presence as well. There's lots of very beautiful shots, but the one where he's kind of doing his hula hooping is very kind of tall and thin, and just the way he stands out in the landscape is very striking as well of his acting.
He reacts to the kind of abuse that is given from people, and that the way he goes to the hula hoop scene. You know, that's the first time he meets Pete and he takes a piss out of him for making the flowers and setting them on fire. And he just goes out in the back and starts hula hooping. And that kind of shows Cody Smith McPhee fill out as a different character. But I think his character throughout the film is really interesting. The way he catches a rabbit and dissects it, catches a rabbit to dissect it, kind of shows the kind of darkness and edge that he has. And he's fascinated with his medical books. It's not just that it seems for surgery purposes, it seems that there's really is a dark undertone to his personality, which we obviously see when he effectively murders Pete, right?
I mean, it makes it all on the first time myself and Katie watched it, you missed those details. But on a recent watch I did the other day, you just realized like how much all of that stuff was premeditated. So like him being ridiculed by Phil and him going to the hula hoops, and then he's going into medical school, and then he's learning the anatomy of the body. Then he's dissecting he's catching a rabbit, and you think, oh, this is so sweet. And then actually, no, he's killed it, and he's actually dissecting the body. You also have him looking through medical books and looking at best ways like of poisoning people and like where the best part to get an infection. Yeah. And then you get that scene where he's riding out on horseback, which is quite interesting because obviously there's a scene where he's learning how to ride on horseback. And there's a part of me that says, did he know how to ride a horse in the first place? And then he's pretending not to know how to ride a horse and then showing to Phil that, oh yeah, I'm learning. But then he's going on the horseback and then he finds that infected bull. And then he starts getting out the gloves. And then that's what I said. It's like watching an episode of How to Get Away with Murder.
It is.
And he does it so great.
You need to piece it together. And one thing I really appreciated was that it wasn't like the usual suspects of like, oh my God, like the mug dropping. And it was like, he was Kaiser Söze all along. It was just, you have to leave and then think like you just did, Kalichi, and went, oh yeah, so that was the book. Oh, right, yeah, anthrax cow, cut in the hand, right, okay, bullwhip, right, okay, yeah, he's like a genius, he's like a murdering genius. Guys, is there anything you want to say before we head to the scores? I want to say Thomas and Mackenzie, she just pops in there.
Very small part.
She's like, hey.
I think that when I saw it at LFF, I didn't realise who she was in it. because it was so in the background. And then it was only like maybe midway through the film, I was like, oh my God, that's Thomasin McKenzie. And it's really weird because obviously myself and Katie obviously saw her in Last Night in Soho. Yeah. So she was having a good year. That's the best way to explain it.
She's had a good run, good career
so far for someone so young. I think it was
her voice that pulled it out for me. It's like that sounds a bit weird. Off you go, Thomasin.
But she injects a nice little humor to it, like the way they play tennis.
She was like, actually,
that was definitely out.
She just kind of reminded people that there's not just men here. There is a female presence here, and there was a little bit of innocence towards when she sees Peter dissect the rabbit. It's like, holy hell, she did see. I think she was probably the first person to see off the cuff that he has actually a darker side to him, but she didn't say anything either. So it just kind of preludes to the whole mystery of that part of the film.
Okay, let's head to the scores, guys.
I'm Helen O'Hara, film journalist, author, and host of Women vs. Hollywood, a new podcast from the Stripped Media family. We're exploring the fall and rise of women in Hollywood, from the silent era to the present day and into the future. Each episode, I'm joined by three or more special guests to discuss the challenges that women face in the film industry and look at what we can do to change the picture. We've got actors, directors, producers, writers, academics, film experts, you name it, they're all here to explain what's going on in Hollywood. Search for Women vs. Hollywood now, wherever you're listening to this, and come join us.
Welcome to our FlixWatcher scores. All of our scores are out of 5. You may have decimal places if you please. And we will start with you, please, Katie, with your recommendability.
My recommendability score is a 5. Highly recommended. That's it. That's
been short but sweet.
I'm sure it's short and sweet. We've said how great it is. I don't think I need to embellish it any further.
Can I see?
Mine's a 5 as well. Mic drop. That's it.
Fair play.
It's definitely a 5. I mean, for me, it's one of those films like, if you loved Jane Campion and you commit yourself to it being a slow burn and you take it in, the reward you get out of it is justified. I know some people have had, you know, mixed results with Jane Campion in the past. Some people probably might find this a little boring. You never know. Everybody has a different style and taste. But it's one of those films that once you give over to what it achieves and you immerse yourself in, I have to give a special recommendation to Johnny Greenwood and his score and the cinematography as well.
Harry Wagner.
Yeah. You are in for a treat. So it gets me, for me, 5 stars.
Helen.
I absolutely agree with everything that has been said so far. I feel that some people will find this a bit boring and be a bit like it's 2 hours and kind of not that much happens until the very, very end. So I'm going to give it a 4.7 just because I know there's people who just wouldn't get on with it and they would find it boring or nothing is obvious in it. And slow burn just isn't for everyone. Some people just like things that are really loud and things that explode and men that are men and you can tell that they are men, whereas this isn't quite like that.
But I did
adore it myself, but I might find it difficult to recommend to everyone.
Yeah, same as some kind of thing to Helen. I'm going to 4.5 here. I think it'd be harder. There'll be definitely people, and yet, like you say, you have to explain, guys, it's 2 hours. Just stick with it. You need to be paying attention. And each time you have to put like an extra caveat in there, makes it like it's a tick off. There's a few more people that are not going to watch it because there's a thing you have to do more of, and you can't just be on your Twitter and your Facebook and Instagram at the same time. But yeah, I'd recommend it to people who have half a brain and are happy to pay attention. Repeat viewing score, Katie.
I would give this a 4.5. It is because of all the things that we've mentioned about the slow burner, the number of hints that are dropped from the start, and seeing how it all comes together is one thing. But then, it, like we said, it is a slow burner. Would we want to really rewatch it just to see, try and pick up everything? I'm not sure. I mean, I would definitely rewatch it, but if it's only just to see what preludes the ending. I don't think it's not complete 5 for me.
Kalechi.
Interesting commentary, okay. I think I'm going to go slightly higher and say 4.6. Just because I think there is more to the film than just obviously just not only just working out how Peter did the crime. but I think you are always amazed by the performances that come out of it. And I think this is probably Benedict Cumberbatch at his best. You see him in a very different light. You know, if you think about him in, you know, Sherlock, if you think about him in even MCU with Doctor Strange, there's a bit of likability in though they're playing chaotic characters. In this performance, he's playing an arsehole. There's no sugarcoating. There's no nothing to it. He's playing an absolute arsehole, but it's also a complex arsehole. And that in itself is very fascinating. And I think it will rank as one of his career best. And something that when you're dealing with a character that has a multifaceted complexity to their performance, I think that's something to worth going back to actually digest and decipher within that mystery that's in his character. So I give it that 4.6.
Helen?
It's interesting you saying that. I find that sometimes Benedict Cumberbatch can kind of struggle with American accents, but he's good in this one. And yeah. I should have added within the recommendability, if you enjoy seeing him naked, then you will enjoy this. So, you know, that is something to note of that. I'm not sure about, I think I would watch this again, but I'm not sure when that would be. It's not one of those ones that you kind of think, oh, I absolutely have to see it again. So I'm going to go 3.8 in that. Perhaps I'll see it again in maybe a year or so. I definitely would want to see it again, but I don't think it's going to be a high repeat viewer for me.
Yeah, I'm going to have 3.5. It's definitely something I'll watch again, because I want to kind of forensically look through Peter's mind. But I don't think I'll watch it that often. But I think, so, you know, you have to watch it again, but not that frequently. Small screen score. I feel we might get some lower scores here. I don't know. Katie?
Small screen score. As we, you know, we watched it at festival, we saw it on a big screen. It actually added to the isolation on the surroundings of 1920s Montana. Having rewatched it the other day on Netflix, I don't think it translated as well as it could have done. So I think I'm going to give it a small screen score of around 3.5.
Kelechi.
I agree with Katie, but I probably go a little bit lower, and that's probably about 3.2. It's not to say that it's bad in that respect. I think when you're watching on a cinema screen, I think you get quickly immersed into the slow burn. I think when you watch at home, and there's, just to reiterate, there's nothing wrong with watching a film at home, but I think there are also distractions, and when you are requiring to get involved into a slow burner of a film, you might miss key points and miss certain details that come with it, unless you've created the most perfect conditions within your household. So it's not something that's really made for TV. It is definitely made for the big screen, and you take advantage of the cinematography, you take advantage of the New Zealand landscapes, and you know, like I said before, with Johnny Greenwood's score, it's incredibly immersive, and it's in slow burn. So yeah, it gets a little bit of a lower score for me when you watch at home.
Helen?
Yeah, completely agree with you that I've watched a lot of very long films at the cinema recently, and time feels different in the cinema to watching at home. Even like having house lights on in home kind of makes it feel different. And yeah, I don't know if it's going to come on in the cinemas in the UK. I don't think it's been on at my cinema, so I think
it came out again like Netflix do. I think they put like a week on.
Yeah,
somewhere.
It was a very limited release a week prior to coming on to Netflix. I think I'm not sure if a lot of people went rushed to watch it because it was going to come on Netflix, but those who did manage to catch it, they were very, very fortunate to enjoy it on big screen.
But also there's just a lot of competition in the cinemas right now. Yeah. So, you know, you've got the tail end of Dune, you've got...
Tail end of Bond,
which is still playing, still sees there. You know, I'm just trying to think of that. You have Ghostbusters. There's just so much happening. So, of course, with something like The Power of the Dog, it would slip through the net. So I don't blame anybody for saying, like, you know what, I'm just going to catch it on Netflix.
Yeah.
Because it's there, you know. So it's not, at least it's not something like The Last Duel, which somehow was in the cinemas, but no one saw it. And then, do you know what I mean? So at least it's there. It's there for everybody to have access for, which is one of the good things about Netflix. At least it gives you a choice.
So what was your score, Helen? Sorry.
Yeah, so I didn't give a score yet. So I'm going to go 3.5 as well. I think I would have liked more of an opportunity to have seen it at the cinema. Yeah, to appreciate the score as well. Like, he's great. Like, I love Johnny Greenwood scores. They are amazing. But it is on Netflix and it's great. They've got kind of new releases coming on there. So you're probably going to be watching it on Netflix.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to go for 3.5. Yeah, let's go for 3.5 as well. I think it would have been awesome to see this in cinema, but unfortunately, I don't think it would have done. I definitely would have seen this in the before times, before COVID, before baby, in my kind of Sunday sessions or Saturday sessions where I would have seen two or three films in a row. And this would 100% be one of them. But yeah, unfortunately not to be this time. Engagement score, Katie.
It is one of those up and down films because it does take a while to get into like the nitty gritty mm-hmm. side of it. So I think my engagement score is around a 4 because once you realize that the plot is going in that really twisted direction, you kind of want to see what becomes of Phil, becomes of Rose. And as the film slowly evolves to include Peter in the mix, it's like, oh, okay, we're going to see where this is going. So yeah, definitely a 4.
Glitchy.
I'm going to go 4.2. I think it was one of those films that really is dependent on your mood and how you, as I mentioned before, how you take to it. If you are happy and you're in the right frame of mind, you don't mind watching on Netflix, and you have managed to just kind of zone out, then I think you will reap the benefits and you will be very engaged. But like with everything that's with Jane Campion, sometimes some people will say, ah, it's a bit boring, and then they will just not really find it interesting at all, even if you start to tease them like, oh no, there's a good bit here, you know, there's like, you know. But as you were saying, Kobe, there's a bit of caveats that go with that journey, but it just comes down to how you actually respond to it. So if you can give to it, then you will find yourself engaged. If you can't, then you're just going to find it boring. So it's, for me, it's 4.2, but that's just because I find it engaging.
That's decent. Helen?
I'm going to go a bit higher. I'm going to go 4.7. Did have to pause it a few times, but that was because dinner arrived and then toilet breaks, and then it was slightly frustrated viewing in that way. Otherwise, it would have been 100%. So yeah, 4.7. I was really engaged and I just didn't really know where it was going. So I was very much like, I don't know where this is going. What's going to happen next? I can't miss anything, because there is a moment where you're like, what? Who? He's in the coffin? What? And I was very much like, what? He's dead? What? He was alive? What did I miss?
Did I just miss like 10 minutes of the film somehow? I think I'm going 4.5. I think if I started this like in the future and wasn't up for it, then you need to dive out and come back later when you're more up for it, because you need to be engaged to be watching this film to get the most out of it. So I'm giving it a high score because you have to be, and you can't. I can imagine many people putting this on like half asleep and then getting to the end thinking, well, that was a pile of shit, wasn't it? So yeah, 4.5. And that gives an overall score of 4.16875, which is high. And it's a small screen score, really, that's let it down, quote unquote. Kate and Kletcher, can you sign off by letting everyone listening know where we can find you online, your Twitter accounts, your blogs, wherever we can hear you, and any podcast you might be on?
You can find me on Katie Smith Wong on Twitter, at Katie Smith Wong, or you can find me on Flickfeast, Wadzilla, Movie Marker, or my own individual blog, musingsofguitargirlchina.blog.
Musings of a Guitar Girl.
Guitar Gal China. It was my old Twitter handle. It made sense at that time.
That's how they work.
They always do.
The amount of facepalm Twitter handles. It was because of a thing Just shut up.
My Twitter was created 8 years ago, and it actually only made sense that I could actually change it now to something a bit easier to spell. So,
well, no one can spell guitar. The guitar girl.
No, no, because they put girl instead of gal. Two different things.
Clutchy, where can we find you online?
Numerous places. I still have a separate Twitter account for my blog and so forth. So if you want to reach out to me personally, it's at K.E. Henulo on Twitter. And if you want to reach out onto my blog, it is at GeekMind UK, and that's available on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
Well, thank you very much, guys, and say goodbye to everyone listening.
Thanks for coming on.
Take care, guys.
Bye.
Enjoyed this episode of FlixWatcher Podcast? Why not leave us a 5-star review on iTunes? You can also follow us at FlixWatcherPod on Twitter, and we're at FlixWatcher on Instagram. Thanks as always to the Mighty People for their mighty, mighty tunes, and Ben from Rockwood Audio for his awesome editing skills. If you're looking to get your podcast edited as sweet as this, get in touch with Ben, and that's Rockwood, R-O-K-K Wood Audio. Tell them FlixWatcher sent you.
You just heard a Stripped Media production.